Somebody once said, and I'm sure you're familiar with this quote, or probably are, "Tell me what you eat, and I will tell you who you are." This morning, in this hour of focus, we'll see if we can extend this kind of analysis to choice of beverage. And our guest for the program is Tom Standage. He is the technology editor at The Economist magazine, and he's authored a new book that takes a look at six of the world's most significant beverages: beer, wine, spirits, coffee, tea, and cola, and how they can be viewed as important technological advancements that reflected the societies that produced them, and in some cases did indeed change the political and economic landscape of the times. The book is titled A History of the World in Six Glasses. Walker is the publisher for the book, and our guest, Tom Standage, is here now spending some time in the United States talking about the book. He makes his home in Greenwich in England, and is out on the West Coast this morning, and was good enough to spend some time with us on the phone to talk about it. He is, as I mentioned, he's technology editor at The Economist. He's author of a number of books, including The Turk, The Neptune File, and The Victorian Internet, which was made into a documentary, How the Victorians Wired the World. He's written about science and technology for many magazines and newspapers, including Wired, The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph, and he is, as I said, joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions are welcome. People who are listening can call in, and all you have to do is use the regular number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people can call in. We just ask callers to try to be brief so we can keep our program moving, but otherwise, anyone is welcome. Mr. Standage, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We
appreciate
it.
Good to be
here. Was there something in particular that started you thinking about beverages as technology?
No, that sort of came later. And what the initial impetus came from was a newspaper article about a wine, a South African wine, as it happens, which was very, very popular in the 19th century. And it was, among other people who liked it, it was Napoleon's favorite wine. And this made me sort of think of Napoleon in a different way, because you think of him normally as a general striding around the battlefield. You don't think of him going home at the end of the day and saying, oh, I think I'll open a bottle of wine. And so I started to wonder what other people in history would have drunk at the end of the day when they weren't being historical figures, as it were. So I started to look into which drinks were popular at which times. And it turned out that that different drinks were dominant in different eras of history. So I ended up with this chronology, which sort of replaces the Stone Age, Iron Age, Bronze Age sort of approach with the beer age, the wine age, the spirits age, and so on. Yeah. So it was only later that I noticed that, as I was writing the book, that I had to explain why each drink displaced the previous drink. And that's very much like the story of why one technology displaces another. You know, why do people switch from VHS to DVD or whatever? And I realized that really what I had here was a classic sort of technology story where you have competing technologies and then one of them becomes more successful than another. So it turned out after the fact to be rather more like my technology coverage at The Economist than I expected it to be.
One of the things that I think is interesting, and I guess is not a particularly profound sort of insight, is that the different drinks do seem to have a personality, or perhaps it is that we associate a personality with the kind of people that might say, this is my favorite. I'd rather have a glass of wine than a beer. I'd rather have a cup of coffee than a cup of tea. And what's interesting to me is when you look at how it is that these beverages developed and who it was that developed them, there is great sort of continuity in this idea of the personality of the beverage and the drinker that goes all the way back to the beginnings of these things, and we still associate those qualities with the beverage and the drinker today.
Yes, I mean, that was one of the things I particularly enjoyed finding out, which is that many of the customs and sort of values associated with drinks have extremely ancient origins. So when you think of beer today, you may think of a sort of rather fatalistic, you know, Homer Simpson sort of character who says, oh, you know, everything's going wrong, you might as well drink beer. But that's actually very much the mentality of the Sumerian culture in Mesopotamia, what is now modern Iraq, which was one of the earliest beer drinking cultures. And similarly, you know, when you think of coffee, you think of a sort of intellectual, and you think of somebody who's very wired, and you know, or maybe a business person. And coffee was first you know, embraced in the West within coffee houses where businessmen and scientists used to meet. So oddly, you do get this sort of continuity of the culture surrounding the drink, and I think that's great, and that's really what I'm trying to. That's why I think drinks are so informative, because what I'm trying to do with this book is encourage people to actually see the history in the drink. I have a cup of coffee right in front of me here now, and now whenever I drink coffee, you know, I can't help but think about the particular historical period where coffee was in the driving seat of history, and that's what I'm hoping other people will do, and that they will sort of see history in these otherwise rather mundane everyday objects.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about all of these things, beginning as you do with beer, which is, interestingly enough, ends up being associated with people becoming settled, people becoming farmers, and probably those other things happen first, but there is a very strong connection between grain, fermentation, making beer, and also people settling down, people staying in one place, and people in becoming involved in agriculture.
Yes, I mean, all of these things go together. The establishment of civilizations, the switch from being a hunter-gatherer to a settled lifestyle, the rise of writing, and the making of beer. And they all happen in the same part of the world, which is the Fertile Crescent, so the ancient Near East. And you get the first civilizations of Mesopotamia and also of ancient Egypt. Yes, I don't think this is a coincidence at all, because you get the first civilizations there because those are the best places for wild grain, in particular barley. And so towards the at the end of the Ice Age, so about 10,000, 8,000 BC, people start to collect this barley because if you collect it and store it in a pit, then it's an insurance policy against a future food shortage. So it's a very sensible thing to do. The trouble then, of course, is you can't really go very far from your store of grain. And so you get a more settled society where you start to have people settling down in semi-permanent and then permanent villages around their stores of grain. And, of course, one of the things that happens with your store of grain is that the water gets into it and it ferments and it turns into beer. And once this happened accidentally, people started trying to make it happen deliberately. And so you get the phenomenon that settlement and beer go together. And in fact, if you had two settlements of farmers, because they then started to cultivate the barley deliberately, and one of them knew about beer drinking and the other one didn't, the beer drinking village would actually have had the advantage, because beer, the making of beer, has the effect of purifying the water supply. And even in a small settlement, the water quickly becomes contaminated. Beer has another advantage, which is it's very nutritious. It has vitamin B in it, and if you're eating less meat, which you probably are because you're not doing as much hunting, then that's a good thing. So ultimately, beer gives an advantage to those people who started to drink it, and as a result, the first civilizations in Mesopotamia and Egypt are founded by beer drinkers, and in those cultures, beer is the universal drink. I mean, everybody drinks it, even the children. And in order to keep track of the supply of grain and bread and beer, which are made from it, and they're used as the currency, so they're actually taken in by the treasury and then paid out to workers to build irrigation systems and even to build the pyramids, then writing has to be invented to keep track of it. So writing, the earliest samples of writing from Mesopotamia contain the symbol for beer very frequently, because it was partly a development to record the distribution of beer.
You can certainly make alcoholic beverage with grain. You can also, of course, make it with fruit. You can make it with honey. That's what mead is. And probably people also did these things too. So yep. Is there any way to know which came first? Was beer really the first alcoholic beverage that people made?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, of course, this is all 6,000 years or so before writing, so we don't have any solid evidence. I am inclined to think that beer was the first widely available alcoholic drink. You probably could have made mead at the same time. So some people say mead is earlier, and I can see where they're coming from. The trouble with mead is that you can't scale up the production in the way that you can with beer, because you need to have your honeybees and so forth. So a small amount of of wild honey could be made into mead. But if you wanted to feed the thousands of people who were building the pyramids, then you wouldn't be able to give them all mead, whereas they were, in fact, all given 4 loaves of bread and 8 pints of beer a day. So I think mead and beer are probably of comparable antiquity, but beer was the dominant drink in that period, simply because you could mass produce it. Wine comes along later. I don't think you can make wine without pottery, and pottery only shows up in the Middle East in about the 6th millennium BC, and you would then have got wine almost immediately. As soon as people tried to store grapes in clay pots, then they would have fermented, and in fact that's how wine was originally made in the mountains of northern Iran. So I think wine probably comes a bit later, and that's why I have the first of my ages as the beer age.
Mm. Whenever I hear about the beer of the ancient world, what the Egyptians would have made or the Mesopotamians would have made, one of the things that I wonder is, would, if you sat down a bowl of this or a mug or whatever it is that they would have liked to drink it out of in front of us today, what it would be like? What would we recognize that it beer? Certainly, I wouldn't think that it would be like whatever one's favorite beer today. You know, it wouldn't be like a Bass, but I wonder what would it be like?
Well, I was very interested in finding this out when I was writing the book. So a number of people have reconstructed Sumerian and Egyptian beer, it would have been drunk initially out of big pots with straws. This was before there were cups, and also it was a way of sort of everyone sharing the drink. That was how it was consumed in Mesopotamia. The key thing that that distinguishes ancient beer from modern beer is that around the 13th century, hops became an almost universal ingredient in beer. And ancient beer, so for most of human history, beer did not have hops in it. So if you want to see what it's like, you need to find one of the rather rare unhopped beers. And they do exist, and mainly they are deliberate recreations of old beers. I've actually got one in my bag, and I'm carrying it around with me when I'm telling people about the books. And so occasionally when I'm doing face-to-face radio interviews, I spring it on people and say, "Here, do you want to try it?" So it's a great disappointment to me that I can't do that with you now. But I can tell you a bit about what it tastes like. Instead of the hops, it has juniper and nettles to balance the taste of the malt. So it's recognizably a beer, but it tastes sort of sweeter and winier than a modern beer, because you don't have this bitterness of the hops to balance the taste of the malt. So it's recognizable as beer, but at the same time, it's clearly different.
And is the alcohol content approximately what a contemporary beer would have?
There was no single answer there, just as there's no single answer today. It's very clear from the Egyptian and Mesopotamian sources that they made about 15 different kinds of beer. And so they made strong beers for special occasions. They made particular beers for religious use. They made weak beer, which we would call small beer, for consumption by children. There were huge ranges of beers, just as there are today, from very, very light to very dark. And they could vary how much malt they were putting in and how much wheat they were putting in. So there wasn't a single answer. So some of them would have been as strong as strong beers, but I suspect that the vast majority of beer was probably quite weak because it wasn't fermented for very long, and because people were drinking it all the time. It was the universal drink, and they couldn't be under the influence all the time. So I suspect a lot of it was kind of 1 or 2% alcohol, and it was really as much a food as a drink, and it was consumed by everybody.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that points to we think about, or at least probably a lot of people would think about alcoholic beverages being somehow debilitating and drinking them not a good thing.
Yeah.
But when you consider the fact that through time, one of the benefits to some of these beverages would have been the fact that it was safer to drink them than it was to drink water, that there would also be some positive connection between health and consumption of these beverages.
Yes, absolutely. And that was one of the big motivations for consuming these drinks, because when you boil the water to make beer, then that helps to remove any nasties in the water. But similarly, wine has antibacterial properties of its own, and it was consumed by the Greeks and Romans mixed with water, and that had the effect of killing nasty things in the water as well. So yes, this was very much part of the appeal of these drinks.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Tom Standage. He is the author of the recent book, A History of the World in Six Glasses. It is published by Walker and Company, and it is a way of looking at history and the development of technology by looking at six beverages: beer, wine, spirits, coffee, tea, and carbonated soda. He works for The Economist magazine. He's technology editor at The Economist and is spending some time now in the United States to talk about his book, History of the World in Six Glasses. If you'd like to read it, you can head out to the bookstore and take a look at it. Questions are also welcome here. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about wine. What sort of advancements in technology would have been necessary to get you from the age of beer to the age of wine?
Well, wine, as I said earlier, is almost as ancient as beer, but it was never as widespread in those two early civilizations of the Near East. And this was because they were both in rather inappropriate climates for growing grapevines. And so instead, the wine had to be imported, and this cost rather a lot of money, and therefore wine was strictly for the elite. So King Scorpion, who was an early pharaoh of Egypt, for example, he was buried with 700 jars of wine in his tomb, and they were imported from the Holy Land, as it later was, from the Levant, as I should probably say, and that part of the world was much more suitable for viticulture. So that shows you that that wine was associated with status because it was rare. And essentially what happened during the first millennium BC, is that wine became more widely available. In two senses, it became more widely available socially in the Assyrian culture and then later in Greek culture and Roman culture. And this is because they were just further north, and so having discovered the wonders of wine, they were in a more suitable climate to grow it. And the Greeks also increased the production by training vines along wooden frames, as we do today. Previously, vines had been left to sort of grow up trees and things like that. It was all rather less organized. So you could increase production by organizing the vines and the way they grew. And this then meant that the consumption of wine spread not just socially and into it was more widely available. It also spread geographically, and wine became a very important export for Greece. Of course, at that point, ancient Greece was the coolest civilization in the Mediterranean. The most advanced, the most cultured, the one that everyone wanted to be like, and they were also the culture that produced this wine. And so everyone who wanted to aspire to be Greek would drink the wine, and they would drink it in the Greek manner, using the right vessels and all sitting in a circle with the wine and water mixed in a pot in the middle. And you get burials in the south of France and Italy and so on, where people who are actually not Greek are buried in the Greek style and they have all the Greek drinking vessels, and this is them showing that they are sophisticated. So wine becomes associated with sophistication because previously it was only for the kings, and now it's for everyone as well. And of course, these cultures look down their noses at beer drinkers. They call them barbarians. And that idea that wine is more cultured and more sophisticated than beer persists to this day.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating that even back then there was this notion that beer was somehow a low-class drink and that wine was an upper-class drink, and that even then also people made distinctions among various wines. That is, that if you were more wealthy, if you had a more refined taste, then there were certain wines for you. There were wines for more common people, and then there were wines for the people who were more wealthy, and I'm sure they thought, and maybe they did, had more sophisticated palates.
Yes, well, this is, it was the case initially, obviously, that the rich did drink wine and the masses drank beer. By the time you get to the Roman period, even the slaves are drinking wine because the production is so huge. It's pretty horrible wine. It's called Laura, and it was indistinguishable from vinegar, really. And then the soldiers had a slightly better wine called Posca. And then above that, yes, there was this whole hierarchy of wines. And a Roman dinner party, you might actually have three different wines depending on the social status of your guests. So if you had a senator, you'd serve him the finest Falernium, and then your sort of middle-class guests might get a slightly less elevated wine. And then if there were people present who had previously been slaves and were now freed men, they were sort of the lowest of the low as far as the freed people were concerned, and so they got a less exciting wine. Yes, the Romans were very interested in this idea that the drink should reflect the status of its drinker. And this idea survives today. I mean, when your boss comes around for dinner, you get a slightly fancier bottle of wine out of the cellar than you might do when someone else came round. So it's that's a very ancient idea.
Mm. Well, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there are some people who are making an effort to produce beer in the style of the ancient world, just so you could have the experience of what it would be like.
Yeah.
The similar question, and this is perhaps more difficult, but you also wonder if we could bring out what we would consider to be a nice bottle of wine to serve to friends or family or guests, and we could then bring out some wine that the ancient Romans would have considered very good, and we set those side by side, what we would think about the ancient Romans wine.
Well, once again, there are people recreating it. And in fact, I went to a Roman vineyard in the south of France near Avignon. And it previously was a vineyard in Roman times. And the chap who runs it now restored it. And he's actually rebuilt the entire winery using Roman sources and in some cases even Roman mosaics as diagrams for things like the wine press. Excuse me. And he now does things like when they do the harvest, he gets some of his workers to wear togas and things like that. And they gather up the grapes, they press them using the Roman wine press, and they ferment them using Roman methods. And what's particularly interesting about this is if you read the Roman recipes for wine, some of them sound rather unpleasant because the Romans modified the taste of wines by adding additives to them. And the one that everyone really turns their noses up today at is seawater. Adding seawater to wine really sounds disgusting. Anyway, of the three Roman wines that this man, Monsieur Durand, makes in the south of France, the seawater wine I think is the most interesting. And again, I have a bottle of it that I'm carrying around with me. And the reason it's interesting is that the seawater and the fenugreek herbs that are mixed together with the wine while it's fermenting give it a bouquet that is exactly the same as a Fino sherry. You often get a sort of salty nose to a sherry. Mm. And then you dilute this with water, and you can see that it would actually be a wonderfully refreshing drink. And so this is why I think reconstructing these ancient drinks is so informative, because on paper it sounds revolting that you have seawater mixed with the wine. It's a very small amount. It's about a 60th part of the whole wine, and it's very well integrated. And in fact, it's delicious. So they really knew what they were doing, the Romans, and I was quite surprised to discover this, but yes, it's surprisingly good.
One other thing before we leave the subject of wine that I thought was interesting that I did not know and particularly struck me being someone who lives here in a university community is the origin of the term symposium.
Yeah.
It was a drinking party.
It was indeed. And in fact, Plato, Plato's Symposium is a great work of Greek philosophy in which Socrates and other philosophers sit around and discuss various philosophical matters. And while they're doing so, they're drinking wine. And this was a common thing that Greek men would have these drinking parties, and they would sit around, and it was a very sort of finely calibrated drinking occasion, because the idea was to be just drunk enough to be to have the freedom of tongue, but not to be actually on the floor. And so at the end of the night, having drunk all night, Socrates in fact walks away. Everyone else is sort of nursing terrible hangovers, but he's not. And this is meant to tell us that he is, he's the perfect drinker, and he's the perfect Greek, and the perfect man, and so forth. But yes, Plato regarded the symposium as a good model for teaching, and so he used to walk around and with his students and talk to them, and then in the evenings they would sit down and have these communal drinking parties where they would discuss matters. And the idea of the symposium, it's a quasi-competitive environment. I mean, you're trying to sort of outdo other people in your wit and your philosophical insights and so on. But there are very strict rules about it. It's also it's an orderly form of competition. And in fact, that's what the Greeks have given us. The basis of the Western way of life is orderly competition. So you have competition between companies, and that gives you capitalism. You have competition between political parties, that gives you democracy. You have competition between lawyers, and you get the adversarial legal system. So this idea of an orderly competition and a civilized, cultured sort of banter of competition gives you the scientific method as well. This is all coming out of the symposium, and it's the basis of what the Greeks have given us and what underpins the Western way of life.
We are about at a midpoint here, and we will talk some more with our guest Tom Standage in just a moment. First, however, before we do that, we must do this. This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Edwards is leading the way. I don't know how he does it.
And this is AM 580 WILL Urbana. Focus 580 is this program. My name's David Inge. And again, I will introduce our guest for this hour of Focus. We're talking with Tom Standage. He's technology editor at The Economist magazine. He has also written for other magazines and newspapers, including Wired, The Guardian, The Daily Telegraph. He's the author of the books The Turk, The Neptune File, and The Victorian Internet, which was made into a documentary, How the Victorians Wired the World. And he writes a lot about science and technology issues. His most recent book is titled A History of the World in Six Glasses. It's published by Walker and Company, and it takes a look at the history of these six beverages and how it is they developed and the connections between their development and the societies in which they grew up. The beverages being beer, wine, spirits, coffee, tea, and carbonated soda like Coke or Pepsi, depending on whatever it is your favorite. He makes his home in England, but he is now visiting the United States, spending some time traveling around the country talking about his book, History of the World in Six Glasses. He's in Seattle this morning. Questions are welcome. We do have someone here on the line, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. That's the number to call. We'll talk with the caller right here. Locally, Champaign-Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello, yes, interesting comment, please, on, like, trade. Did they just expand peacefully, or more like the Caesar's legions later, did they actually have colonies? And what about the concept of zero? Someone said they learned about it, but they didn't like to use it. Ciao.
Well, okay. There certainly is a relationship between beverages and globalization, I guess. Maybe that's the way to kind of think about it.
I mean, beer you couldn't really transport, so it was generally consumed, you know, where it was made. And then wine was traded locally, so particularly within the Mediterranean basin. So the Phoenicians, for example, were great traders in that area, and they are thought to have carried winemaking as far as Spain. And they also carried other things with it, like the alphabet, and they spread that around the Mediterranean. And yes, the Greeks and the Romans set up colonies elsewhere. I mean, the southern French Roman colony was a big wine producing area. And they're still finding these shipwrecks around the Mediterranean now with thousands and thousands of amphorae of wine in there. So this was a huge thing. Wine does also link to the Roman military expansion. In fact, it's quite closely intertwined with the Roman military in several ways. One, for example, is that Roman soldiers were given a liter of wine a day, and it was this wine called Posca, and it has, like all wine, it has a natural antibacterial property. So if you mix that with water, which is how they consumed it, it purified the water, and that meant if they were on the march or they were besieging a town, then without realizing it, they actually had quite a good water purification system there, and I'm sure that gave them a military advantage over non-wine-drinking opponents. Another way in which Roman military was influenced by wine is that when you returned from a military campaign, you were very often rewarded with land, and the most prestigious thing to grow on that land was in fact was vines. As the Romans did better and better, they started giving away more and more of the land around Rome to people to grow vines on, and they started growing less and less grain, and they started to have to import grain from North Africa, eventually the many many vineyards around Rome were sort of amalgamated, and this drove people into the city. And Rome becomes the largest city in the world, and its population exceeds 1 million for the first time, largely because of this increase in production of wine. Finally, the staff of the sort of badge, the emblem of a Roman centurion, was a staff cut from the sapling of a vine. And this is because the vine reminded the Romans both of where they'd come from. They thought themselves as humble farmers who had somehow become this great military power, and it also reminded them of where they'd gone to, because they were this great military power. They were, you know, a great sophisticated civilization, and wine sort of encapsulated both of those things. It's on the one hand a simple crop, and on the other hand a sophisticated drink. So there were very close relationships between wine and the Roman military.
Yeah, it's interesting that roughly speaking, you can see the limits of the Roman world by looking at the line between where people are wine drinkers and where people are beer drinkers.
Yes, and I don't think that's a coincidence at all. I mean, in England, where I come from, you can see very clearly in the archaeology that when the Romans show up, everyone starts drinking wine, and then when the Romans leave, everyone goes back to beer. And this is because drinking wine was an important part of the Roman lifestyle. And when you were within the Roman trade network, you got hold of all this wine. And in fact, they even made wine in England in Roman times. And then once the Romans disappeared, that aspect of the culture went with them. And so yes, now you have these sort of beer drinking cultures in Europe, and then the southern wine drinking cultures, and by and large, the distinction between the two is the distinction between whether they were part of the Roman Empire or not.
Let's talk with someone in nearby Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Didn't catch the early part of your show, but I'd like to suggest another drink that has just pretty much totally disappeared that has had a pronounced effect on us. And that is a beverage that was made in pre-Columbian America, in the Central America, that was made out of coca. For chocolate, and that drink was consumed very greatly in Mesoamerica, but we turned it into chocolate bars and stuff like that. It consumed it a different sort of way, but then went on to become a very, very, very expensive crop.
Well, actually, cocoa is one of the drinks I didn't include. I had a list of drinks that almost made it. And at the time when chocolate was, I mean, yes, you're right, it was the elite drink in its indigenous part of the world in Central America. And then it's brought to Europe, and it appears around the same time as coffee and tea in the 17th century, and it starts to become popular. By and large, chocolate was more popular in Catholic Southern Europe, while coffee was more popular in Protestant Northern Europe. And the era in question, I think, is marked in particular by the scientific and financial revolutions which happen in Britain and in Holland. And in those countries, coffee was far more important than chocolate. So that's why I have an age of coffee at that point rather than an age of chocolate. I can't really see any sort of broader geopolitical implications that follow from the popularity of chocolate. So it's one of the drinks, along with mead and gin and a couple of others, that almost made it as one of my drinks, but didn't quite.
The drink didn't make it so well because it wasn't very, very palatable, but to our taste. But the product that came from it,
yes,
had quite a substantial effect on the world. I mean, everybody seemed to like chocolate.
Well, I agree, and perhaps I should do a history of the world in several foods, in which case I'll have to consider it. But in this case, I'm concentrating on drinks, and I'm in particular interested in the drinks that had these broader links to world history. And I can see there are some links, obviously, with chocolate, but there are stronger links, I think, with other drinks at that point. And coffee is really in the driving seat of history during that period. So that's why I've gone for coffee rather than cocoa. But that's not to say I don't like a occasional cup of hot chocolate myself, but I drink a lot more coffee.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Kankakee for the next caller, line number 1. Hello. Is there a caller there on Kankakee, line 1?
I thought it was line 4. Your guest is to be commended for introducing a wonderful lens for viewing history. The possibilities for symposia are fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Caller must associate himself with the previous caller on chocolate from the standpoint of world and Western Hemisphere history. Chocolate is certainly a key. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Again, other questions, comments are certainly welcome, too, as we continue to talk with our guest, Tom Standage. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, let us move on and talk a little bit about the two caffeinated beverages, coffee and tea. And I wonder to what extent, we talked a little earlier about the fact that there were societies in which a lot of people consumed some kind of alcoholic beverage, even children did, in more dilute formulations, and that they did that because it was safer to drink than water.
Yeah.
So to what extent did the popularity of coffee and tea owe itself to not only to the stimulant effects, but to the fact that, again, because the water was boiled, it made water safe to drink, but it wasn't intoxicating?
No, exactly. I mean, coffee was coffee had an enormous impact when it was introduced, simply because here it was as a non-alcoholic alternative to water. Of course, unlike drinking beer for breakfast, which is what people in Europe were generally, beer or wine for breakfast, is what people were generally doing when coffee appeared. Unlike those drinks, coffee wakes you up. I mean, it sharpens the mind rather than dulling it. And this was noticed almost immediately. This coffee drink, one observer writes in 1660, hath caused a greater sobriety among the nations. And people started to realize that that they'd been in this sort of alcoholic haze for centuries and centuries. So another poem published in London in 1674 calls wine the sweet poison of the treacherous grape that drowns our very reason, and beer is foggy ale that besieges our brains, whereas coffee is a grave and wholesome liquor that makes the genius quicker. So this was, even at the time of coffee's introduction, it was very quickly apparent that that Europe was waking up. And this had an amazing effect because both the drink itself and the places where it was drunk, the coffee houses, were new, and they were imported from Arabia, and they made possible all sorts of new things. In particular, they were venues where people could get together, drink coffee, and discuss things. They were respectable venues where you could meet people and do business and have political discussions and scientific discussions, and you know, you couldn't do any of those things in taverns. And so an amazing flourishing of innovation occurred. And we get things like the scientific revolution, where scientists, you know, reinvent. They get rid of the old Greek theories which are wrong and establish new ones. And so Sir Isaac Newton, who writes his theory of gravitation and the Principia Mathematica, and essentially lays the foundations for modern science. He writes that book to settle a coffeehouse argument, in fact, about the nature of gravity. Then we also get the financial revolution. So we get stock exchanges. We get things like the South Sea Bubble. We get all sorts of new schemes of lottery and insurance. Lloyd's of London comes out of a coffee house called Lloyd's. Jonathan's, which is another coffee house in London, becomes the London Stock Exchange. So there's this amazing sort of acceleration of intellectual activity that is stimulated by coffee.
How is it that, given the fact that in England there were people who drank both tea and coffee, and that coffee was certainly important, and as you say, it has this connection between intellectual pursuits and commerce with the development of the coffee house. How is it, though, that when we think of the national drink of England, that is tea?
Yeah, it was a bit of an accident, really. Tea and coffee appear in London about the same time. And initially, tea is more expensive because it's had to come all the way from China, whereas coffee has only had to come from Arabia. So initially, it's all about coffee. But then Charles II married a Portuguese princess, and part of her dowry was a chest of tea, because the Portuguese were among the first European nations to import tea into Europe. So tea becomes fashionable at the London court, and then the aristocracy all want to drink it too. So the East India Company, which has been granted a monopoly on trade with the East, starts to bring it in from China, and gradually demand starts to go up, and the East India Company realizes it's got a monopoly on an extremely valuable and sought-after commodity. Initially, tea is so expensive that you actually have to lock it up, and that's why tea caddies exist and why you have locks on them, because this was a very expensive luxury. But as the volume of imports went up, it became far more widely available, and by the end of the 18th century, so much tea was being brought into England that everyone could afford to drink two cups a day. Even the very poorest people could afford to have it. So this was rather a sort of curious British phenomenon, and it had these strange and far-reaching political effects, because in order to secure the tea supply, the East India Company ended up dictating foreign policy to the government, and you get things like the Boston Tea Party and American independence. And then in the East, you get the Opium War, which is where the British government goes to war with China, ostensibly about, you know, free trade, but in fact to defend the East India Company's decision to pay for the tea that it's importing with opium, which it's growing in India. So this is sort of state-sponsored drug running. But this shows you the extent to which the tea trade perverted British foreign policy.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening here. We'll go to Chicago for our next caller on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi, I came into your conversation kind of late, so I'm not sure if you talked about the fact that all of these drinks you seem to name are stimulants, that they're mood-altering. And I was wondering, because hunter and gatherers, when they use mood-altering substances, substances, usually herbs. It's usually related to a religious ceremony. And I was just wondering if you had any thought about whether settling down into groups or just the stress of living in society creates a greater need for having a mood-altering substance all the time.
Yes, I think there's a lot of truth in that. Some anthropologists divide hunter-gatherer societies up into smoking and drinking cultures. So a lot of the North American tribes, for example, were predominantly smoking cultures. And then subsequently, when the colonists arrived and gave them, you know, hard liquor, they were, they responded to it as if it were a hallucinogenic substance where you had to consume enormous quantities of it, and you know, it was no point in being slightly intoxicated. You had to be totally intoxicated. So yes, I do think that was a part of it. And beer was, of course, used in religious ceremonies in Egypt and in Mesopotamia. It was thought to be a gift from the gods because the exact process by which the gruel fermented into beer was not understood. So it was just thought to be magical. This was therefore a gift from the gods, and it was the right thing to offer them. So yes, all of that fits together. The other thing is that yes, when people settled down and became farmers, it was a much less enjoyable lifestyle. I mean, swanning around as a hunter-gatherer, you could spend a lot more of your time at leisure, whereas being a farmer was much harder work. But there was compensation in the fact that you could at least make beer. So some people have suggested that this was the sort of trade-off, that people were prepared to settle for this more arduous lifestyle and more stressful lifestyle in return for the ability to have beer. Yes, you have a more stressful lifestyle, but the beer makes it worth while.
So is there any sense that as we increase in complexity or stress that we increase the level of our stimulants? You know, for example, Coca-Cola, which had some coke in it as compared to cocaine.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think the opposite is true. I think today there's a backlash against all of these drinks. I mean, my six drinks, three have alcohol in them, three have caffeine in them. But the fastest growing drink category now is bottled water, and that seems to be, you know, the appeal of bottled water seems to be on the basis that it's pure and it doesn't contain stimulants. So I think a lot of people now are saying, you know, we don't have to have these stimulants all the time, and we can have these sort of purer drinks. And, of course, a lot of bottled water actually just comes out of taps anyway, so it's not really particularly pure. I mean, well, it's as pure as it's all just the same. The bottled water is no purer than the tap water. But I think that's why people prefer the bottled water over the tap, which is that they feel that it is pure and it's desirable for that reason, and not so it's desirable because of the lack of stimulant rather than because of the stimulant.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, I do think it's interesting you make that comment about water, that that in fact you do at the end of the book identify a possible seventh beverage, and that being water.
Yeah. So I according to my chronology, we are now at the end of the cola era, and I think it's pretty clear that the next era will be the drink that defines the next era is water, and it's already the fastest growing category, but as well as being very popular, bottled water, I think there are other ways in which water sort of will define mankind's future. There's growing, political tension over water in many parts of the world, and I think that's only likely to increase with climate change and water being more scarce. And furthermore, if mankind is going to move on from planet Earth and go to other places, starting with the Moon and Mars, a prerequisite is that you find water in those places, because you need it to grow crops, to make oxygen, and to make rocket fuel out of. So, in fact, NASA is going to launch a probe to look for water at the on the Moon, because they want to build a moon base there now, and they're going to need to find water if they can do that. So I think, these other drinks have been steering the course of history for the last 10,000 years, I think water is now getting into the driving seat.
We have two other callers, so we'll get right to them, but I do want to again introduce our guest for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We're talking with Tom Standage. He is technology editor at The Economist magazine, and his book is A History of the World in Six Glasses. It's published by Walker & Company, and he suggests that one way to perhaps take a look at human history and the development of technology is to look a little bit at the history of these six drinks that we have been talking about: beer, wine, spirits, coffee, tea, and carbonated soda. We have some other callers here. The next up is in Urbana, I believe, line number one. Hello.
Yes. If based on a program we had on the radio here yesterday, if people are going to go up into space, I would recommend that they bring powdered Gatorade along with their water.
Yes, Tang was supposed to be the drink of the space age there as well.
Oh, that's right, yeah. That was,
and
that was,
and in fact, the Russian astronauts very clearly have a favorite drink, which is vodka, because being on the space station is pretty horrible. I mean, there's nothing to do up there. They don't do any science. Pretty much all they do is fix the space station so they can stay up there, which is kind of a bit of a circular argument. But yes, it's traditional that when they send the Soyuz capsules up to the Russian astronauts, they lob in a bottle or two of vodka, and they put them inside the spacesuits that are in the capsules, apparently, and then that way they can maintain their supply. There was even talk of developing a special beer for consumption in space that was going to have added vitamins and so forth. I'm not quite sure what came of that plan, but I liked the idea of space beer because beer obviously was, you know, the earliest drunk by the earliest civilization. So the idea that there could still be new kinds of it specifically for spacefarers tickled me.
Did you ever see that one Jerry Lewis movie where he has there's a Russian cosmonaut has a powdered vodka?
No, I haven't seen that. I don't know how you'd. I don't think you could do that. But it's. I can see the. It makes sense because obviously the Russians, including the astronauts, are very keen on their vodka.
Yeah, well, it was a joke, of course. But I think I'm pretty sure it was Jerry Lewis, and I know for a fact that what happened was he wound up, you know, swallowing an entire vial of this stuff, so he had to put down a whole gallon of water.
Well, spirits are one of my drinks. I do them all together, but I do them in the Age of Exploration because that's the point where the first European explorers are heading out from Europe, and they want these drinks that survive on long sea voyages and pack lots of alcohol into a small space. So I don't consider spirits in the space age. I consider them in the colonial period.
Yeah, you know, the Romans put little pieces of lead in their wine.
They used all sorts of things in their wine. They did put lead in, then they put seawater in, and they put chalk and lime, and they put, I mean, an amazing range of additives. And today we say, oh, that's horrible, you know, wine should be pure. And in fact, at the time, Romans said that the best wine was the wine you didn't need to mess with. But it's just that the product wasn't a very consistent product. So travelers would often take a little pouch of herbs and things with them so that when they were in a roadside inn and they were of wine and it was a bit dodgy, they could adjust the taste in their own way. And in fact, there is a sort of vestige of this idea hanging around today, which is the use of oak. I mean, you know, for some reason we think the use of oak to flavor wines and to sort of balance, you know, if there's a weaker vintage and you sometimes oak it more, for example, that for some reason is accepted, although other additives are not. And that's really an arbitrary distinction. And, you know, there's no real reason why we should be allowed to use oak in wine and not other things.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Thanks.
All right. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi, Tom. This is Luke Wallace calling from Urbana. I should probably be at work right now, but I've been cheerfully listening to your program for the last hour. Being in the wine business, I'm curious how many producers, growers you visited throughout Europe that were using clamphora or growing grapes in the old provenage method, and did that surprise you how many people were making wine in the old way?
Well, I went specifically to this Roman vineyard, and okay. I intend to go to another one at Pompeii because there's a couple of Italian winemakers who specialize in the old grapes and the old methods. And they are replanting the vineyards at Pompeii, and they're going to be making authentic wines there. But the only one I actually specifically visited for this period is the one in Avignon. So I didn't go to any others. There is a resurgence in some of the older methods that the Romans used.
And what's the name of the Avignon vineyard, please?
It's called Tourelle. Which is it's called Master Tourelle, but the website is www.tourelle, which is tourelles.com, and it's a bilingual website, and it tells you all about what they're doing right there. And the winemaker did all this in conjunction with André Chernier, who is a great French authority on ancient wine. So it really is academically and archaeologically very sound indeed.
Thank you very much. Also, one recommendation, check out Castello di Lispida and Jasco Gravina. They're in the northeast corner of Italy.
Oh, thank you.
Doing the same thing with Provenage and or clamphora.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll try to get one more here. We'll go to Savoy. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. I'm really enjoying the show, and I'm really enjoying all this wonderful information. I haven't seen the book yet, but I don't think that you can have a history of the world without talking about the development of tea in China.
No, that is one of the drinks, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it. But one of the things I'm trying to show is that these drinks have reached our cupboards and our kitchens today.
You mean ours in America?
Well, I mean around the world. I mean, tea is a very widely consumed drink. I mean, a lot of people in India drink tea, and the reason they do is the British introduced it there. So I'm actually trying to show how these different world cultures interconnect. So we have an Arab drink here. I have some in front of me in the form of coffee, and yet I'm in the west coast of, you know, at Seattle, which is now the center of coffee culture. And then, yes, in Britain we drink tea, even though it's from China, and everyone drinks Coca-Cola from all over the place. So, in fact, drinks provide a way to show how interconnected different cultures are.
I'm just wondering if your book talks at all about how tea influenced the development of technology, well, religion, culture, and I guess by definition technology, writing, and so on in the Far East.
Well, tea is actually not as ancient a drink as the Chinese say it is. They say they would drink it since 3000 BC, but in fact, it only really started to be drunk in the first century BC. So writing and so forth in China actually predates tea by quite a long way. One of the things that tea is associated with is the development of paper money, because the tea merchants were having to send such enormous amounts of money to each other that they started to use banknotes instead. So that's one of the technological developments that that arose from tea. But yes, I do talk about tea in China and the Tang dynasty and so forth, and that is part of it. So,
and it was originally adopted by the monks, if I understand it, because it had a way of keeping them awake during their long meditation.
Exactly right. Yes, that's what it was for. And similarly, coffee was adopted by the Sufis in Yemen to keep awake in religious practice. So all of these drinks very often have religious connotations as well.
Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. That's an interesting point to end on. I do think that the fact that there are certain sorts of religious, mystical, sacred connections to all of these drinks, with the possible exception of Coca-Cola, and that is still the reason that we continue to have toasts. And that to lift a glass to the gods, to each other, and when people get married and on other special occasions, that's one of the reasons why we do that.
Yes, no, exactly. I mean, there are some very ancient customs that have survived to this day with drinks, and that's probably the most obvious. So if you raise a glass and say cheers, you know, here's to a happy marriage or to a safe journey, you're somehow, you know, the implication is that the alcohol somehow enables you to call upon a higher power. And this is exactly what people thought when they first discovered beer. They thought it must be magical, it must be connected to the gods, and by offering it to the gods in that way, you could ask them to do you a favor. So in fact, that survives right to this day, and it's kind of a pagan thing that we do, and we don't think about why we do it, but that's what's happening.
Well, it is a fascinating and very entertaining story, and I recommend it to anybody who would like to have something fun to read, and you'll learn some things as well. It's A History of the World in Six Glasses by our guest Tom Standage. He's technology editor at The Economist magazine. The book is published by Walker & Company, fairly recently out, so you should be able to find it in the bookstore. He makes his home in Greenwich in England, but he's now spending some time in the United States to talk about the book. He's out on the West Coast this morning. And Tom Standage, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.